It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, many of us are guilty of speeding when we drive and probably don't think much about it, but state officials say it caused a lot of crashes, injuries, and lives lost last year. We'll look at the problem and what can be done about it. First, for a long time, the United States has prided itself on its free market values, where countries in Europe or Asia have embraced a bigger role, the role of private industry. But our next guest says in recent decades, we've gotten that all wrong. He says if you look at the data, Europe is actually where you see some of the healthiest competition. And he says American consumers and workers are paying the price. Thomas Philippon is a professor of finance at New York University's Stern School of Business. His new book is The Great Reversal, How America Gave Up on Free Markets. Thomas, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you take an epic journey through economic theory and the economies of the United States and Europe in this book, but you started off with a really simple question. Can you talk about what led you into this book?
Yeah, so I came here 20 years ago from France, from Europe, and 20 years ago I was struck by the fact that many things were much cheaper here in the US than they were in Europe. And what struck me in recent years is that this situation has reversed. And it's striking that American consumers are paying by far much more for their cell phone plans than pretty much anybody in any other country.
That's something that might come as a surprise to Americans. And you're right, it's not just cell phone plans, it's internet and many other things. And we're not even necessarily getting any better quality than our European peers. Can you spell out how big a difference there is?
So the difference is in the telecom industry, the differences are staggering. It's like a ratio of more than 1 to 2. So take your typical household in the U.S., having broadband internet at home, they would pay something like $70 per month for Comcast or like Verizon, broadly speaking, for like high-speed internet. So $70 per month in the US, the same thing in Europe costs about $30. Okay, so it's like 30 versus 70. You're paying an extra $40 per month just for that. For cell phone plans, it's about the same. So the basic cell phone plans in Europe start around 10 euros. You can get unlimited data for, maybe 20 or 30 euros per month, which is less than half of what you pay here for the same service.
Now, there's a stereotype, I think, among American economists, certainly American politicians, that here in the U.S., we do the free market right. Over there in Europe, there's this hidebound bureaucracy that limits the economy. You say if that were true in the past, maybe it's changed. What is driving that change?
Oh, it was definitely true in the past. And the reason people are still convinced that it's like that is because it was a defining feature of the U.S. 20 years ago, or for more of the post-war period, really. It was a defining feature of the U.S. that it had the best free market. And when we say that, it's not in some abstract concept. Free market means, as a consumer, you get a good deal in the sense that you have lots of choices and you don't pay too much. Okay. Today, that's clearly violated. If you want to buy, let's go back to broadband internet. On average, most households in the U.S. don't have two choices. They cannot choose for more than two providers to get broadband internet at home. The median household in France has five to choose from. Okay, so not surprisingly, when you have five, these guys compete for their customers, and therefore their prices are much lower. So why is it like that now? I think it's actually both sides of the Atlantic changed. The irony of the story is that Europe changed mostly by importing good American ideas. So the reason Europe has very competitive market in the telecom sector, in the transport sector for airlines, cars, and trains, most of the time, if you look at the reason, you see that Europe adopted ideas about regulation or deregulation that were first implemented in the U.S. So by and large, you can think of what happened in Europe was a successful import of good American ideas. So it's a bit of an irony that today American consumers are, getting the the bad deal while European consumers get the good deal. In the US, what happened was a reversal of a long tradition, of free markets. And you can see it, it goes all the way from antitrust for very big firms down to, licensing requirements at the state level.
Thomas Philippon is with us. We're talking about his new book. It's called The Great Reversal, How America Gave Up on Free Markets. Thomas, in your conclusion, one of the things you say surprised you was how fragile free markets can be. What happens when a company gets so successful that it can start to control, have influence over the regulations that are placed on itself?
Yeah, so I think that's the biggest issue. You get the thing that's fragile that I didn't quite realize before writing the book is, usually when we think about the economy and the markets, the reason we don't worry too much about monopoly power is because we think that if in a particular industry firms are making too much money, well, then they're going to attract competition. People are going to notice that the margins are very fat in a particular industry, and therefore they're going to go there, compete, and 5 years down the road, you're going to have lower margins and more competition. So, but the key mechanism there is entry by new competitors. And this is the thing that has failed in recent years. So the big firms in many industries have been really good at preventing entry and competition. Now, the way they did it is always a mixture of, lobbying to get their mergers approved, lobbying to get the regulations they want, very aggressive tactics against would-be entrants, what we call predatory behavior. And all of these pieces together means that they've successfully managed to, prevent competition in many industries. And at the end of the day, it's the consumer that ends up paying the price. And it's a lot of money. I mean, so I do the math in the book, but the median household in the US earns about $50,000 per year, give or take. Now, for that person, for that household, I should say, for that household, they are losing about $5,000 of real income, of real purchasing power from excessive rents, from excessive prices and monopoly power throughout the economy. So that's a lot of money, like 10% of their income.
And part of the story, you mentioned lobbying, and you also have a chapter on campaign finance laws being different between the United States and Europe. Do we have a system here that gives a corporation, if I have this powerful corporation, does the American system give me more influence, more sway than I might have in the European Union?
Today, yes. But again, that's somewhat of a reversal of history. Of course, lobbying has always existed, and lobbying is oftentimes a good thing because you need industry to have a voice if you want to have good regulations. So it's not as if I'm in favor of banning lobbying. I think that would be I don't think that's the right way to think about it. But excessive lobbying power, that's a problem. And I think it becomes excessive when the politicians themselves become dependent on very large campaign finance contributions by large firms. So that speaks really to the issue of campaign finance. I think the biggest difference today is that regulators in Europe, sometimes for funny reasons, actually, and these are like some unintended consequences, but the good type, regulators in Europe ends up being very much more independent from lobbyists than they are in the US. And so they keep enforcing the rules of free market without paying too much attention to lobbyists. Well, in the US, the regulators are much more subject to heavy pressures by lobbyists, either directly or indirectly via elected politicians. So I think that is the heart of the issue in the US today.
We're talking to Thomas Philippon, an economist from NYU's Stern School of Business. His new book is The Great Reversal, How America Gave Up on Free Markets. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see this lack of private sector competition in your own life, in your own business? Do you feel like you're getting less for more with things like cell phone plans, cable plans, airline tickets, and more? Do you think there need to be changes to make the U.S. a more competitive place. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you bought those kind of things on both sides of the pond, love to hear from you as well. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Thomas Philippon, author of the book The Great Reversal, How America Gave Up on Free Markets. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about how the U.S. and Europe compare on things like regulation, on prices of key products, on policies, on things like lobbying and campaign finance, the influence that gives companies over what the laws that regulate them? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Thomas, before we bring on a caller, I want to talk about the latest news with the coronavirus, Congress working on an economic relief plan. You have tweeted recently the concern that some of the same companies you're looking at with lobbying power might be able to sway the system, abuse the system of relief to their own benefit. What are you worried about?
Yeah, I'm worried about the wrong companies getting the dollars from the government. So I think that the relief should be first and foremost targeted towards people who lost their jobs and small and medium-sized enterprises. People who lost their job, that's for obvious reasons, because they are left with no income and no chance to find a new job because people are supposed to stay home. And that actually is quite difficult because people who were in the gig economy, who had part-time work or freelancing, you know, they don't typically have access to unemployment insurance. So you need to design the package in a way that also reaches these people. I think that's very important. And that's the improvement we've seen today in the new deal that's being discussed in Washington. And the second thing is on the firm side, I think the large firms have many ways to get liquidity. They have commercial paper. They have bonds. They can access this through in various ways. The small firms are the ones who need the support. And the problem is they don't have the same lobbying power. And so the first thing you saw after the beginning of the crisis was airlines lining up for government money. Well, bailing out the airlines is not the priority. You know, bailing out restaurants and small businesses is the priority.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Robert on the line in Chicago. Robert, hello.
Howdy, and thanks a lot for the show. I just think that the whole situation can be viewed, and I hate to bring strong terms. I don't mean to point fingers or be outrageous, but quite simply, our national legislature and our state legislatures are corrupt. And it's a nasty word. I actually don't even want to use it, but it means that the people that they owe for getting into office in the first place are moneyed interests.
Robert, I want to jump in because you don't have too much time with Thomas. He's saying whether you want to use the word corruption or not, Robert pointing toward legislators at the state and national level being beholden, he says, to some of the corporations you're talking about.
Yeah, but corruption has always been a problem in every country. The U.S. historically is not a very corrupt country. But I think that you can be influenced by lobbyists, even if you're not corrupt. I think it doesn't necessarily come with a moral statement. It's just that if you need to spend half of your day dialing for dollars as soon as you're elected for the next campaign, that's a problem. That means you're just not going to do your job properly.
Thanks a lot for the call, Robert. We'll go to Marcus now with us in Madison. Marcus, hello.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Philippon. I wonder if you could comment on this. The United States has always been prone to the concentration of large monopoly corporate power. And I think it's significant that the U.S. is the only major developed country that doesn't have a labor party. And the labor union movement in the United States since World War II has mostly acted as a disciplinarian of the union workforce rather than as an actual advocate for workers. And since we are so weak in that regard, I wonder if you could comment, please, on whether this is a factor.
Marcus, thanks. Thomas, yeah. The role of labor.
Yeah, so that's a very good question. It's also a very complicated one, so I will not be able to do justice. just two key points. The first one is monopolies have been important in every country. The US both had a tradition of big firms, but also a tradition of busting the trusts. You know, from Teddy Roosevelt onward, the tradition was that you were also suspicious of big firms. In fact, after the war, after World War II, the US implemented in Europe some of its policies, in particular in Germany, by removing the big firms. So that tradition is also very strong in the US. So I think that's the first point to keep in mind. The thing that's important also is, in the past, this was a bipartisan issue. Like in my book, I try very hard to show that this can be a bipartisan. It's not Democrat versus Republican. Everybody has an interest in free markets. And everybody means both the left and the right and labor. If you look at the debate in the 70s and 80s with respect to big firms at the time, where the airlines and AT&T, actually there was some consensus. And there was work both by the labor movement and the antitrust lawyer to think about antitrust. Because to be honest, like having competition in the goods market is the same as having competition in the labor market. And that can also be good for labor.
Thanks for that call. Thomas, we have just a couple of minutes left. Give us a policy prescription or two to try to bring back what you'd like to see, a real free market competition that could drive down costs for American consumers.
Well, okay, so priority number one is to, now we are talking about hopefully after the coronavirus lockdown of the economy. But clearly, priority number one is going to be protect small firms and medium-sized firms because they're going to be hurt the most. So, you know, first do no harm should be the main mantra here. And the big firms are going to survive the crisis. Make sure the small firms also do. That would be point number one. Point number two, tighten up a lot merger reviews. So I think we've seen way too many acquisitions in particular by large tech firms of firms that could become their competitors. So we need to put a stop to that. The third one would be make sure that this is done in a bipartisan spirit, because this is the kind of long-term policy that it doesn't work very well if every 4 years the new administration tries to undo what the previous one did. So the most important is to try to create a bench, like some consensus about what free markets are, why they are good for everybody, from the entrepreneurs to the workers. And then once you have this platform, then you work on it.
Thomas, thanks so much for joining us today. That's Thomas Philippon, an economist from NYU's Stern School of Business. He joins today to talk about his new book. It's called The Great Reversal, How America Gave Up on Free Markets. There's no Republican primary in Wisconsin this year. The party here is firmly behind President Donald Trump and even blocked other Republicans from getting onto the ballot. As Sean Johnson reports in the first of a series called Swing State about the upcoming elections, a lot has changed in the 4 years since Wisconsin Republicans made a last-ditch effort to stop Donald Trump.
By March of 2016, the once enormous GOP presidential field had dwindled. Former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's presidential bid was a distant memory by then. Trump was surging, but there was another Republican in the race who, in theory, had a chance at stopping him. Texas U.S. Senator Ted Cruz.
Now, what makes you think that you can win Wisconsin?
Well, because you got good people here who are fed up with what's happening in Washington and are ready for a real change.
When Charlie Sykes, the former conservative talk radio host for WTMJ Radio, effectively kicked off Cruz's Wisconsin primary campaign in 2016, he told him he'd do whatever it takes to help stop Trump. And Sykes kept his word. Other Republicans, like Congressman Glenn Grothman, would come on his show and attack Trump.
If your 8-year-old child behaved that way, you'd wonder if there was something wrong with them. You'd chastise them. This is the president of the United States.
The experience left a mark on Sykes, who has since left the airwaves in southeast Wisconsin. He's a never-Trump conservative, but today he doesn't have much company. Sykes keeps a photo of Ted Cruz from that campaign on his wall as a reminder.
I keep that picture up because it's so ironic. What's happened to Wisconsin since then, what role Ted Cruz has played since then, and it's kind of, it feels like a postcard from another world.
What's happened is that a party that once scorned Trump now embraces him. To fully appreciate this, it helps to look back at where they started. In 2016, Cruz had endorsements from Walker and other prominent Republicans. Trump had Van Mobley, the president of the Wisconsin village of Thiensville, a community of about 3,100 people. Mobley says he thinks other Republicans were slow to warm to Trump because they saw him as a threat.
The GOP establishment in the state, and by that I mean Paul Ryan, Scott Walker, Reince Priebus, they had imagined a lot of futures, and a lot of those futures were with themselves at the center of the Republican Party.
Jay Weber, the conservative talk radio host for WISN Radio, says he didn't like Trump at first because he was abrasive and brash. But unlike Charlie Sykes, Jay Weber says his feelings on Trump began to change. Trump rolled back executive orders from former President Barack Obama, pushed deregulation, and signed a major tax cut. Today, Weber supports Trump and thinks people like Sykes are the ones who've changed.
Donald Trump has accomplished all sorts of things that Charlie Sykes and Bill Kristol and these other never-Trumpers said they wanted to get accomplished over the last 30 years as conservatives.
The Wisconsin primary of 2016 seems like ages ago now. Ted Cruz won Wisconsin and said he'd stay in the race as long as he had a path to the nomination. But a month later,
I'm sorry to say, it appears that path has been foreclosed.
The Wisconsin GOP plan to stop Trump fell apart. Sykes admits he was wrong about Wisconsin that year. He thought it could be a game changer.
Well, I certainly thought it would be. I wasn't necessarily part of a strategy, but I did think that we were going to be this firewall of rationality. Instead, it turned out to be a minor speed bump.
Trump kept on going and took voters with him. He won just 35% of the vote in that 2016 Wisconsin primary. Today, the latest poll from Marquette University found Trump had a job approval rating of 95% with Wisconsin Republicans. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, you may not think that speeding is a big deal on Wisconsin roadways, but our guest says it's a serious problem here in the state. He'll tell us why, share some of the numbers from last year, and what, if anything, can be done to slow us down and keep us safer on the roads. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the State Department of Health Services released the details of a stay-at-home order that takes effect tomorrow. We'll find out about the guidelines and the list of exceptions for people and businesses. First, take a guess at what the top traffic conviction was in Wisconsin last year. Drunk driving might pop in your head, but no, that wouldn't even crack the top five. The correct answer is speeding. In fact, it's not even close to the next biggest one, operating while suspended. There were more than 146,000 convictions for various levels of speeding in 2019. More serious is that speeding is responsible for more than 21,000 crashes, resulting in 159 deaths and 8,000 injuries. Given how common speeding is, what, if anything, can be done about it? David Pabst is the director of the Wisconsin Department of Transportation's Bureau of Transportation Safety. He spoke with Central Time producer Bill Martins.
Now, you told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that speeding is the main issue in the state in terms of convictions. How so?
Well, if you total up all the convictions related to speeding, it far outweighs any other citation that's issued each year. So you're talking over, 100 and some thousand tickets issued.
Now, can you break that down a little bit? There's varying degrees of speeding. How does that work?
Well, at the basic speeding level, if you will, there were 29,000 citations, and that's speeding excess, that's 20 or more over the limit, that's at 28,000.
Okay.
Speeding at 1 to 10 over, you're looking at about 38,000 to 39,000. And then speeding intermediate is a most popular category, if you will. It's 11 to 19 over the speed limit. There are almost 80,000 of those issued.
Wow, so people are they're not going just most people aren't going just a little bit over, but they're not going way over. They're going somewhere in the middle.
Right. 11 to 19 over is the largest category, and it is the number one violation cited across the state.
Now, how dangerous is speeding, especially when you compare that to something like drunk driving or driving while distracted, you know, with your devices or something?
Well, it's right up there. The three of those are our primary issues that we have. And, of course, all of them can be prevented because it's a choice you make to drive distracted. It's a choice you make to drive drunk, and it's also a choice to speed. And so speeding represents about 28% of our fatalities. So last year in 2019, there were 21,000 crashes, over 21,000 crashes that involved speeding with 8,000 injuries and 159 deaths.
Now, I'm not defending speeding here, but I mean, at least if you're going fast, your eyes presumably are still on the road, your hands are on the wheel, whereas if you're drunk or you're looking at your phone or something, you know, that's kind of another factor that makes it more dangerous, right?
Sure, that makes it more dangerous, but speeding in and of itself means if you do one of those other behaviors like picking up your phone and looking at it for something, you're going that much further every second, and you have that much less time to react. So speeding contributes to a lot of crashes.
Can you somehow quantify the difference? It's kind of a weird question. The difference in risk when we're going 10 over on the highway versus, say, 10 over on a city street?
Well, certainly the lower the speed limit, the faster you go, the bigger the consequences, because on those lower speed limit roadways, there's more pedestrian traffic, so it makes it much more dangerous for those around you. Mm-hmm. And we do know that the more fatalities happen on the surface streets and the rural highways versus the interstate, even though the interstate speeds are higher, the other highways just aren't as safe.
I'm guessing I was going to ask you what the penalty for speeding is. I'm guessing that would depend on how fast you're going and how many times you've done it previously, right?
Sure. You know, the speeding starts out at $175 and some change for the lower levels. And the most common category we're talking about, 11 to 19 over, is at $200. Now, if you're doing it in a construction zone, there's an enhancer where the basic deposit is doubled. So the range there is $213 to $263.
And there are points as well, right?
Right. The points go up, you know, 3 to 6 points. If you're going 25 or more over anywhere, basically, you lose your driver's license for 15 days, and you have to pay a fine of around $250. So the highest speed citation that you can get if you're in a construction zone and going 45 or more miles per hour over the limit, you're looking at $894, roughly.
Now, you mentioned that speeding is a choice. It can be preventable. So what can we do that'll cause people to speed less? Is it a matter of having, like, more enforcement, more education, maybe lower speed limits? Or, you know, does the solution really lie with each individual driver?
It's each individual driver. We have really strong, enforcement programs. We have educational programs, but there's no stigma with speeding. Everyone seems to do it, and so there's no social pressure to not speed. And I think that's one of the items we need to change is change the culture so that it's not so acceptable. If people realize that 170 some people died in Wisconsin alone, or 160, because of speeding, they would realize that it really is a serious problem.
And everyone's just in a hurry.
Right. We live in a very fast-paced society, and we got to get there now. But if everyone were to, obey the speed limits, we'd all get there safely.
We're talking with Dave Pabst of the Wisconsin Department of Transportation, looking at the top traffic convictions in the state. Speeding is number one. Dave, let's talk about some of the others. There were nearly 24,000 for OWI offenses, more than 16,000 for driving with a prohibited blood alcohol level. You put those together, that would rank sixth. So are we getting better, are we getting worse, or are we staying about the same with regard to OWI?
Well, over the last 10 years, we've actually cut the number of convictions, basically, or the fatalities involved with drunk driving in half. And the convictions have been going down somewhat, but there's some other issues, of course, that we talked about that are taking its place. So distracted driving is coming up there, where people are on their phones or doing whatever, you know, looking in at the map or whatever, and they are actually being distracted on the road, and that's contributing to our deaths on the highways as well. And of course, if people would just buckle up. Seatbelt use is one of those important things that if you make some of these other errors, it will help save your life.
I was going to ask you about the seatbelts as well. That came in at number four, more than 41,000 convictions. Why do you suppose people aren't buckling up?
Well, I'm not sure. It's really simple, but we do know in Wisconsin that we're over 90% for the first time. Our last survey showed that we're at over 90%, so we're at about the national average. And, you know, those other 10% of people that aren't wearing their seatbelts represent half of the fatalities that we have. So we just need people to start buckling up.
And that's the law, right? You have to buckle up?
Right. And it's a primary enforceable statute. So that means if an officer sees you without your seatbelt on, you can get stopped just for that.
Yeah, it's not like they have to pull you over for something else and then notice you don't have the seatbelt on. They can get you on the first. They can get you for that alone.
That is correct. And seatbelt use, like I say, you may have all the most expensive safety features on your car, but if you're not seatbelted in, none of them will help.
Especially if you're speeding.
That's correct.
Now,
speed with that.
What are some of the other traffic violation trends you're seeing? We've talked about a couple of them so far. What are some of the other ones?
Well, you know, the ones that really cause a lot of the fatalities and serious injuries, it always has to do with driver behavior. And so it's so important that people, you know, signal their turns and make a proper left turn. Left turns are really dangerous. And that's why we've gone to roundabouts to prevent those direct impacts. You know, they're more glancing blows when you have a roundabout, so they're much safer than the classic intersection. But intersection-related crashes are really bad. And then, of course, people are not stopping for stop signs. Every day on my way back and forth from Middleton into Madison, when I go to work, I see people cutting the lights, and they're not even cutting the lights. It's turning red, and they're still running right through them. It's just one of those habits. People are in such a rush. It comes back to that society that has to be there now. It's just so important to get where you're going so quickly that you're speeding, and then you're not slowing down for red lights or stopping for red lights. You're running them, and it's getting really dangerous out there.
You know, this all sounds like kind of basic driver's ed stuff. I mean, how do we correct these behaviors? Do we have to? I mean, what do you do? What's your message for? I'm babbling here. What's your message for Wisconsin motorists and how to be better, safer drivers? This is essentially what I'm getting at.
Well, I think everyone it starts at home. Be that good example for your kids and for anyone else in the car that you're driving. Show them how to drive properly. We used to be a nation of drivers, I believe, and we took pleasure in just in driving and being good at it. People aren't driving on purpose. Now it's just a tool to get from point A to point B. So people need to drive like they mean it and pay attention. Put the phone down, be aware of your surroundings, and set a really good example.
Good place to leave it. David, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Bill.
David Pabst is director of the Wisconsin Department of Transportation's Bureau of Transportation Safety. Producer Bill Martins talked to him about speeding in Wisconsin. The DOT says in 2019, 159 people were killed in speed-related crashes. 8,000 were injured. Coming up, the state has issued a safer at-home order that goes into effect tomorrow. We'll find out what that means for Wisconsinites and different types of businesses. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in this time of overwhelming feelings and uncertainty, a lot of us are seeking comfort and connection online. We'll talk about the ways people are creatively using technology to connect and share information. Now, the State Department of Health Services, at the direction of Governor Evers, released the details of a safer at-home order today in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. It closes non-essential businesses and requires people to stay in their homes as much as possible, but it comes with a long list of exceptions to those guidelines. The order is scheduled to go into effect at 8 a.m. Wednesday, that's tomorrow, and it's scheduled to stay in place until April 24th. Wisconsin is the 17th state in the country to put these types of restrictions in place. Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. Laurel, welcome back to the show.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, we were waiting yesterday to see what the details were going to be as far as what is an essential business, that kind of thing. What stands out to you, Laurel, that we've learned today that we didn't know yesterday?
Well, what we didn't know yesterday really were more of the specifics, and that was kind of the pushback that the governor got, particularly from Republican leaders, that he didn't outline what businesses were considered essential. The answer that we have today is kind of complicated in that a lot of things are going to be able to stay open. So places that you might expect, like grocery stores, pharmacies, medical facilities, those are all going to be still open under the order. But some places that you might not necessarily expect, like hardware stores, pet food stores, for example, are going to be allowed to stay open as well. So it's a pretty broad order in terms of what is going to be able to continue operating, I think.
And in terms of what kinds of traveling people are able to do, what does this order outline as acceptable reasons?
So for this order, it distinguishes between essential businesses, non-essential businesses. It does kind of the same thing with travel. So it says any essential travel can continue to happen, and it defines that as travel that's necessary for providing care to a family member that needs that kind of support. Any travel that is to or from an educational institution, specifically for the purposes of getting the materials that you need to do that distance learning that so many higher education institutions are doing these days, or travel that is getting you back to where you live. So if you have been, traveling and you're somewhere away from your residence, you're allowed to get back to that place, get back to your permanent residence under this order.
Are there businesses that are very specifically not exempted that are that have to be closed at this point?
So we know some businesses that have actually already been closed. We have a little bit more clarification. So malls have been closed. Those are still closed under this order. One that folks were a little bit unsure about, weren't sure if they would be deemed essential or not, bookstores. So bookstores are closed under this order. One of kind of the tricky parts about this, Rob, and I alluded to this earlier, is that, kind of the expansiveness of it. If a business can be deemed one that supplies things necessary for people to work from home, so if they offer materials for people to be able to do that, they can stay open. They're deemed an essential business. So there's definitely some wiggle room here, and I think that's what's led to the volume of requests to the State Economic Development Agency, the WEDC, today that actually crashed their website. They put up a website for businesses to reach out if they were a little unsure, and that website actually went down for a bit this morning.
And as I understand it, in trying to read the legalese of the proclamation, a business can, I guess, challenge or request an exemption from the guidelines if they can make the case mm-hmm. that they're essential. There's a procedure for that, right?
Absolutely. So that's actually at the same site where businesses can go to see what the different exemptions are and get some more detail and nuance on that from the WEDC. The website is wedc.org/essential business. And after you're kind of clicking through all of the things that outline all the different businesses, all the different exceptions, there's a form at the bottom that you can fill out and see if you can be designated as an essential business, kind of file that petition and be able to continue operating. I think it's important to mention, though, Rob, that businesses don't have to have any sort of special certification or special certificate or something that's going to arrive in the mail that says, hey, this is our permit to be open right now. It's just following these designations in this order. So there's no other sort of apparatus in place, no permits or anything going out to these companies.
We're talking to WP. a safer at home order issued by Governor Evers' administration this morning to take effect starting tomorrow morning. Laurel, how about enforcement? Does the proclamation say anything about how all this is going to be enforced?
So the kind of brass tacks answer to that is there is a penalty written into the order. People that violate it can be fined up to $250 and actually be put in jail for up to 30 days. But in a press conference with the governor and other state officials today, they pointed out that they're really hoping that that kind of enforcement isn't going to be necessary, that people are just going to comply with this because, as the governor said, you know, this is kind of in the spirit of community and everybody trying to limit physical contact to slow the spread of COVID-19 in Wisconsin. So they're hoping that just sort of making this appeal and setting these guidelines for people, that kind of, monetary, punitive sort of those sort of measures aren't going to need to be implemented.
You mentioned, Laurel, that Republicans weren't happy with the lack of detail yesterday. What are we hearing now that the detailed plan is out?
Well, there's been some sort of reflecting, I guess, on just the way that it was rolled out. I think Republicans are going to be talking about that for a while. Just the fact that the governor tweeted out that he was going to be doing this order yesterday. There was a lot of confusion about sort of what the essential businesses were going to be. Republicans have been reflecting on that even more today now that we have the specifics. There's also been the pushback about, you know, how far is too far for limiting the economy and sort of placing burdens on particularly small businesses in Wisconsin. And that's something that the governor actually directly addressed today during his press conference this afternoon. He said, we completely acknowledge that this is going to make it very difficult for some businesses in Wisconsin, but he said it ultimately for him was a calculus between choosing, between supporting the economy in that way and placing a value on human life is what he said. So there's definitely a push and pull there.
One of the big unanswered questions right now, Laurel, as we've been hearing during our news breaks, is the scheduled election here coming up on April 7th. What's the latest talk about that right now?
Well, that has really been changing a lot. I've been covering that closely for WPR. And as of right now, there aren't any big changes to, you know, election day, still scheduled to go off as normal as possible on April 7th. The governor weighed in on that again this afternoon. He said he's continuing to encourage folks to vote by mail if they can, request that absentee ballot online, myvote.wi.gov. You can also do it by contacting your clerk's office. He said it's pretty easy. He actually made a little joke today in the press conference. He said it's so easy to do that I did it. So that's really what they're pushing folks to do right now.
That's one unanswered question. Are there still things in this safer at home order that you and your colleagues in the Capitol Press Corps are trying to get answers to?
Well, we actually, through our Wisconsin effort, listeners have been submitting questions for us. We have more than 60 specific questions about how this will be rolled out and how it affects people. So we are working our way through those questions right now, and we're going to be posting an in-depth Q&A about how this affects people and businesses on WPR.org as soon as we're done with it.
And this is scheduled to stay in place for a month. Basically, is that presented as a solid date or something that might roll past that as conditions dictate?
As we're seeing with a lot of other things with COVID-19, it is pretty flexible. They're putting it up as a, this is the date we have right now. This might need to change. Things are changing very quickly. So as you mentioned, the order is set to go right now through 8 a.m. on April 24th, but the order has specific language that specifies, hey, we could change that date at any point with a different order in the intervening time. So this is definitely something we'll be keeping an eye on.
And as the governor and others have made a big point, grocery stores, again, are open. They are staying open.
Yes, grocery stores will be open. Pharmacies will be open. So folks are able to get the things that they need so they can stay home and be safe in their homes.
Laurel, thanks a lot for getting us up to speed.
Anytime, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio's state capitol reporter. She joins today to talk about the details of a stay-at-home order that the State Department of Health Services released earlier today. It goes for 1 month. You can find more coverage about this and a link to the order itself at the Wisconsin Public Radio website. It is easy to find, WPR.org. With all the shutdowns in the sports world, a lot of us are going to be hungry to see some kind of entertaining competitive events. Weird ones are popping up on social media. I saw a marble race, for one thing. It was pretty compelling, actually. A lot of lead changes. It went right down to the wire. And on the sports channel ESPN, they are digging deep with sports like cherry pit spitting and axe throwing finding their ways into the weekend rotation. But here's a competition we can all watch slowly in real time, a competition between all 50 states. And as of today, Wisconsin is in second place, and we have the lead in our sights. The competition, Census Returns. The U.S. Census 2020 website has a national map showing how states stack up in the rate of census surveys that get filled out and returned. Right now, Nebraska is in the lead with a rate of 27.5%. Wisconsin just pulled ahead of Iowa for second place after being tied yesterday. We moved up to 26.7%, Iowa just behind at 26.3%, and Minnesota and Kansas are close behind, rounding up the top five. We have some ground to make, but people, we could go all the way. You can follow the action at the Census 2020 website. It looks like it's updated daily. Start your own fantasy census league, draft states, and see how it all plays out. And is there gambling on this? I'm not sure. Wouldn't surprise me. Sports news you can use. This is Central Time.